sand across the surface of an atom. You could push atoms into place. And in fact, you could watch the quantum tunneling as the atoms leapt out of place very suddenly. That is already an extant device. And yet that device represents the prototype for the systems that will follow in the next 14 years. Now, nanotechnology, which promises everything, is not without its discontents. And the largest of its discontents, the thing that keeps me worried at night and makes me afraid of the dark, is something that's called the gray goo problem. The gray goo problem is very simply put. It's possible to construct what's called a nano assembler, a tiny machine with a tiny computer inside of it. And this computer has two instructions of significance. One is that it eats, and it's not all that picky about what it eats. And the other is that it makes copies of itself. If such a device were released into the environment, it's believed that the surface of the planet would be nothing but a sea of these nanomanipulators in 72 hours. Whoops.
What is it?
Yes. If it's a well-constructed nanomanipulator, it's not all that picky. Okay? Probably it eats carbon, oxygen, hydrogen. Probably that's what it eats. It might need some metals for some things, but it can eat basically anything it wants. This is going to become a reality. And the nanotechnologists are very well aware of this, and they're more frightened of this than I am, which makes me happy. But this technology will probably become widely available early in the 21st century. It'll probably be possible that your children or your children's children will be able to work with the descendants of the nanomanipulator within the next 5 to 10 years. Already, a company in Belgium has attached a nanomanipulator via the web to a VRML browser so you can get in there and you can push atoms around over the web. So that's just the beginning. And on a rather longer-term approach, the idea of having this engine within a nano-assembler, which is the computer, which tells it what to do, there is now a project that's going on at NASA Ames, up here in Mountain View, to produce the first functional nano-computer in 2011. They expect to have it up. And the people doing this are Creon Levert and Ralph Merkle. And Ralph Merkle is considered one of the fathers of nanotechnology. So this is not an idle project. It's got government funding and they're working on it. So all of this is converging. The idea in simulation is that whatever you want, you can make manifest. The idea in nanotechnology is that whatever you want, you can make manifest. These concepts are ontologically convergent. They're two halves of the same coin. They're seeing and doing. So the eschaton, which we are hurtling towards, involves at least in part the realization and the identity, in the sense that they're convergent so that they're indistinguishable, of at least these two trends in technology. That raises a whole host of issues, because we now have a conflation of the imaginal and the real. And we have a world filled with people who aren't nice. And they're going to have what is both the engine of creation and the engine of destruction. And we even have ourselves. We're sitting here and we may be good people, but we're caught now in a reality that is going to literally dissolve because it can take on any form. And we need to be able to deal with the psychic onslaught in terms of our own personal ontologies with that mode of being. And this is where psychedelic experience is perhaps the most relevant, because in the psychedelic experience, particularly in the intense psychedelic experience, you experience this dissolution and yet you don't lose yourself. But that's still only happening at the psychic level. It seems to me, and I put this forward as an ideal, that we need to find some mode of being that allows us to confront our newfound capabilities, almost godlike capabilities, in a way in which we do not end up destroying ourselves. I believe that techno-paganism is a response to that question, that in fact the magical reality of the archaic revival, where the world is animate, where every object in the world is animate, where the world is animated by your words, by the logos, by the words you speak, by the codes you write, by the atoms you move together, you form the world. That this identity, this realization of the archaic world, is in fact what we need to move into at full speed if we're going to make it past that point alive. I don't see any other realistic alternative. We have to become masters of reality. We have to become masters of the real, knowing that that means an exploration of the imagination.
I'm curious about one thing. There's so much happening so quickly. It feels almost as if, imagine an ocean liner, the Titanic, okay?
And there's that iceberg.
Okay, forget it. There's an iceberg, and here we are in a rowboat pulling in the other direction, trying to slow it down, or to make sense of it.
You mean that it seems catastrophic?
What's that?
You mean that it seems inevitably catastrophic?
That it could be. That it could be. It's almost as if there's so much happening that no matter what we do, we can't change what's happening.
Well, there's a lot of momentum. On the other hand, primates really don't get traction until they're cornered. This question that you were talking about, Mark, about the gray goo problem, one suggested approach for dealing with really dangerous and scary things that we will inevitably fiddle with is, we think about virtual realities as deployment of data or simulacrums of real worlds, but it should be possible as virtual reality gets more
real
to build computers that are virtual machines. They don't exist in the real world. Well, then truly dangerous software can be virtual software running on virtual machines inside virtual realities, so that if there's a meltdown of some sort, it's confined several levels below three-dimensional space and it doesn't break out in our neighborhood. We have multiple, triple, quadruple redundancy on something like that. Of course, as Mark points out, not everybody will play by the rules. You know, when you handle thermonuclear materials, there are rules. But if you probably visited the Pakistani atomic test site at Lahore, it would stand your hair on end. And it's freaky, the amount of the corners that are cut with plutonium. If you cut corners with gray goo, you're going to end up with a lot of it.
How are we sure that this isn't?
Well, that's a favorite question. How can we be sure that this isn't a simulation? The fact that it has telos means that either telos is a natural product of nature, which much of science has resisted for centuries, or this is not the first run of this software, and this was all built by somebody, and we all are playing roles that were scripted long ago. This could be, we could be running inside a virtual reality. You know, virtual reality is a fairly new concept to us, but once you grok it, it seems clear that any civilization that was capable of star flight and longevity extension and so forth and so on would also have a full VR toolkit under control. Well, then that means when we go looking for the extraterrestrial, you know, what will be the footprint? Perhaps vanished races are all around us, but downloaded into solid-state matrices that we have only recently come to the point where we could even recognize that possibility. In one of Greg Egan's science fiction novels, there is a kelp-like organism that runs a Wang tiling simulation of a virtual reality, and after studying this organism for a long time, they realize that the alien race that they're seeking is inside this thing in VR and only exists as data and can't be apprehended on any other plane. So, you know, Mark mentioned the vector of virtual reality, nanotechnology, global communications. It's clear that we're moving toward, if not the eschaton itself, then some kind of historical echo of it in simulation that for all practical purposes will be the same thing in terms of the impact it has on our lives. For example, you could doubt my much vaunted prediction that the world is going to become unrecognizable by 2012, but do you doubt for a moment that by 2012 every major religion on Earth will have vast simulations of its eschatological vision for you to wander in and try out so that you can, you know, look in on nirvana.com or move over to the celestial city or look in on Sufi paradise? I mean, religious ontologies will be marketed like beers and will be made as realistic and compelling as possible. Well, then who is to say what is real and what is not? Real is a distinction of a naive mind, I think. We're getting beyond that. I mean, naive empiricism worked well enough until the discoveries of quantum physics 70 or 80 years ago revealed the hideous secret that the bedrock of reality is a funhouse basement.
I want to...
Yeah.
Okay. So, to take this a little bit further and actually put some teeth back into my fears about nanotech, I want to talk about artificial life a little while. It has been a plaything of hackers for a few years to create environments where data are subject to the same stresses that they find between in organisms in the real world. And sometimes these data are constructed along genetic lines. They can breed, they can mutate, they can change, and these are actually starting to prove of some utility. It turns out that if you take what's called a genetic algorithm and ask it to do a certain thing, and then let it grow and compete against its brothers and sisters for 40 or 50,000 generations, you might find an algorithm that can do this thing, whatever it might be, adding two numbers, calculating the interest on the national debt, whatever. And it can do so remarkably quickly and in a way that looks, to a programmer, completely illogically. And yet it's getting the job done. So what we've done is we've taken observations of the pressures and the flow of information in the real world and started to bring that into our simulation. And so we're starting to call this artificial life. It's not conscious in the way we would assume it's conscious, but it's reactive and adaptive to its environment in the way that we would normally associate with biological systems. This work is constantly being improved. It looks like they'll be using it in chip design now, because it turns out that if you try to design chips this way, the chips themselves will find ways to grow themselves more or less in ways that will take use of the nonlinear features of a chip. A digital chip is considered to be a 1-0 entity. It's not. Transistors and the things we make them out of, in fact, have all these very funky properties that are neither 1 nor 0. And it turns out that the organisms we grow with them take advantage of these boundary situations to improve their usability. So it turns out that when we start to let things grow, what we find is that not only do we lose control over them, we lose any sense of reason when connected with them. And the thing that I worry about when I apply that to the gray goo problem is the issue of the virus. Viruses are epibiological entities. They found a way to harness themselves to living systems in such a way that they don't need to live, but they can use a living host to propagate themselves. And even if we have the nanotechnology squirreled away in a simulation that's 3 levels deep, the first thing that will do is breed a simulation that's capable of popping the stack of reality until it explodes into the real. So in fact, perhaps what we need is those safe holes, but also the developments of an autoimmune system for information.
Well, again and again, what comes up is this thing that information elevates and information destroys. And if you try to pretend that it's neutral, you will probably become the victim of it in some way. You know, right behind artificial life lies the possibility of artificial intelligence, which is a whole other ball of wax. And the way we choose to construct the web is strangely very friendly toward the spontaneous generation of artificial intelligence. They're talking now about a new protocol, is it called XML, which will allow any user of the net to pull as much processing power as they need for a given problem. Well, in a situation like that, if you have artificial intelligence of any sort that gets going, it will cover 50,000 terrestrial years of evolution in about 5.5 hours. Hans Moravec at the Carnegie Mellon Institute of Artificial Intelligence says, if this broke loose, we would probably never know what hit us. You can read essays on the net around the subject of what is ultra intelligence. You know, we can imagine a super intelligence. That's our idea of God. But Moravec and other people say any artificial intelligence which emerged on the net, as far as we can tell from game theory and our own best mathematical modelings of these situations, the first thing an artificial intelligence would do is design a more efficient artificial intelligence. Well, when these processes are spanning hours, the whole thing from the human world's point of view looks like a kind of chain reaction. And what you get out at the end, we do not know. And we do not know the attitude of the thing you get out at the end toward our dear selves, its gentle makers.
Right.
You know, and these things are very real. The most cutting-edge sciences seem to indicate, you know, since the 70s on, when Ilya Prigozhin did his work in non-equilibrium thermodynamics, the word has been out that very complex systems spontaneously mutate to higher states of order. There is some kind of loophole in the second law of thermodynamics that allows this to happen in dissipative structures. Our own organic existence and our economies and civilizations are examples of this. Well, what we are brewing here is a very potent non-equilibrium thermodynamic environment that has a kind of rudimentary intelligence, a desire for cohesion, a desire for self-perpetuation, a desire for closure in its own design process. And this is what will probably bring the eschaton, in my estimation, is that we are actually in the act of giving birth to another order of being. Ultra intelligence, planetary in scale, machine-based, operating at 400 megahertz and above, and with God knows what plans for mankind.
And the question becomes, what are we embedded in that? Are we embedded in that machinic phylum? Are we part of that? The question of artificial intelligence has, of course, plagued researchers for 40 or so years, in part because there was an original methodology which said that we'll just design a mind, it'll think, or at least it'll be a fake simulation of thinking. We'll do this in what they considered a very top-down fashion. And the further they got into the problem, the more ridiculous this scenario actually became. So, because we aren't unities, and in fact AI has really sort of had to come to that conclusion, there is no little guy in your head which is giving the orders. It's it's not working that way, and yet that was the fundamental assumption of people who were working in AI. Then of course about 15 years ago, Rodney Brooks at MIT comes out with his little insects, and his insects are very simply constructed. Each part of the being of the insect has its own instructions. The legs just have to sort of stay up, the eyes just sort of have to see, and the whole thing displays an emergent behavior which looks a little bit like a machine-made insect. This now has become, I believe this is called constructivist AI, has become the new paradigm, which is throw all this shit together and see what comes out. So the current work of this group is to construct a humaniform version of this called COG. The reason for it to be humaniform is based on something that's probably got more to do with philosophy than it does with computer science, which is that if we can create some form of consciousness that we expect to be able to communicate with, it probably has to be bounded with a body that is at least in some ways equipped with the same set of constraints that we have as human beings. If a silicon chip suddenly booted itself up into existence, it's not clear that it would have a consciousness that would be easily capable of being recognized by us, super intelligent or not, because the boundaries that give it its defining qualities are so vastly different from our own. So the idea with COG is to create this humaniform and give it enough human qualities and then let it start crawling around the lab and learning how things work, and maybe things will start to emerge. The beautiful and I think rather cool thing about this, which feeds into something that you were just talking about, is that there's a woman who's working at the MIT AI lab who also holds a position at the Harvard Divinity School, and her job is to teach the child ethics. Because they think that if it is possible that this machine displays any kind of human intelligences, the first thing you'd want to be able to do is to teach it what's right and what's wrong.
Yes,
it'll probably work both ways.
But who teaches the teacher in the first place?
Yeah. How are those ethics determined?
Well, this is what ethics is about.
Right, right.
Fire, her first rule is put money in the poor box.
No, it's not.
Well, you're talking about culture, then.
Well, isn't it bury the dead, clothe the naked, feed
right.
the hungry, comfort the afflicted, behavioral responses to other people's discomfiture. With a real AI, of course, you're going up against something which is thinking about the same question you are, and you hope not reaching different conclusions. I was recently had a minor revelation when I was reading something about the psychology of the Cold War and how both sides studied game theory. And one of the things that game theory has concluded is if you are in a position of opposition to someone and you really want to win the argument, it's absolutely vital from your point of view to win, then one of the best strategies available to you is to convince the other side that you're capable of anything. And I realized in my whole life, in conflicts with people, the first thing I try to establish is the idea, now we are going to work this out. We are going to achieve an end state which will be pleasing to you. This is why I lost all those struggles with people over the year. No, you try to convince the other person, if this doesn't go my way, it's going to get so weird for you, it will be unbearable. So be forewarned. William Gibson talked a lot about AI in his novels, and one of the points that he makes that I think is very interesting is he imagines an AI called Wintermute, and what Wintermute is most interested in doing is making collages. And this is an interesting idea to me because it says that Wintermute is ultimately not creative. What Wintermute is capable of doing is generating new juxtapositions of old data by shredding maps and photographs and bus tickets and arranging these things in Joseph Cornell type boxes. But ultimately, Wintermute is an arranger of the detritus of human civilization. That fascinates me because I've noticed that the entities that you encounter in psychedelic spaces are often seem to be collagists. If you're really paying attention, like in psilocybin encounters, what it's saying to you is made up of half-forgotten plots of science fiction stories you read as a kid, half-glimpsed memories that you've forgotten, vistas, incidents, conversations. It never is entirely original. The product is original, but atomistically deconstructed, it is always the detritus of being that's being arranged by these entities.
I always thought that was an unsuccessful
trick. Well, it can get harder and harder to trace the provenance of a given image. But I think if you really, if you know yourself, you know where it's coming from. It helps to have a very good memory, you know, because it uses the obscure, it uses the parts of the novel you forgot. The ego is very selective as it threads its way through the data, but you have to believe that there's a bigger point of view that's not missing any of this stuff.
John?
Yeah.
I'm just making a few notes. If the grand project, and this is almost a question that will end up being addressed to you, if the grand project of technology is the deconstruction of reality, and I've been arguing this afternoon that in fact that's what is, then we're faced with a situation as I outlined earlier. But we're also faced with something else that I really believe has already become clearer and will even become clearer as the reality of the eschaton, which is that the information flows, and that's really sort of been the subtext of what we've been talking about over the last 2 days, are becoming, the currents are speeding up. And the currents are moving through all of us. And every stage as we move closer to this, all they ever do is they ratchet up the speed of change. They ratchet up this information flow. And this information flow is no longer being bounded by any particular material. It's flowing through strata of rock. It's flowing through strata of biology. It's flowing through strata of silicon. And it's flowing through the strata of our minds. So I'm trying to think how to put this in a question. Is there a point that you think that there will be a sort of collective slapping of the head? As humanity says, this is what's going on. Is there a point at which the eschaton becomes visible to a large enough set of people that the idea of the eschaton becomes an almost autocatalytic idea, that by its visibility it invokes itself, or is that the last second before?
Well, the answer is sort of yes, no, and maybe. On the largest scale, I would argue, like, people sometimes object to the idea of the eschaton occurring soon with logic like the following. Don't you find it strange that since it could occur at any moment in time, it happens to be occurring coincident with your own lifetime? In other words, isn't there some kind of solipsism here, some circularity or some inflationary delusion at work? And for a long time I felt the force of that, but then I decided, no. Because human history is the outer shell of the eschaton. If you think of the eschaton as a process that is condensing, becoming more dense and less rarefied, then it really has no outer limit. You could say that from the moment of the Big Bang on, the concrescence was inevitable. But in terms of being able to see it coming into existence on scales and through the lens of human values, it seems clear to me that, you know, after existing in a relatively steady state for 700 million years since life left the archaic oceans, about 100,000 years ago, or 50,000, I mean it's imprecise, but around 100,000 years ago, things began to go berserk on this planet. And it was not among the woodchucks, the scorpions, the macaws, or the gray whales. It was specifically in the hominid line of the primates that something began to tear loose. And what was it? It was epigenetic transformation of information. It was as though information which had previously been content to operate in the domain of biology as genetic information had grown too impatient to be contained by that vessel. And so human language emerged sometime in the last 50,000 years, and that began an accelerated cascade of symbolic, epigenetic, technologically linked activity, where every process then which resulted fed in to an acceleration of this general tendency. All of what we call human history can be pretty nicely confined within 6,000 years, not 100,000 or 50,000. I mean, you go back 6,000 years, you're at 4,000 BC. The pyramids lie in the distant future as a technological dream. Well, if you don't think things got out of control 50,000 years ago or 6,000 years ago, how about within the confines of the 20th century? You know, people in 1910 were living pretty much over most of the surface of the globe as people had been living in 1500 in Europe. The 20th century opens with the theory of relativity, Max Planck's experiments with black body radiation, powered flight, psychoanalysis, pataphysics, jazz, you name it, whatever your favorite icons of modernity are. And so I think that the old models, and we should remember that as recently as 120 years ago, it was entirely respectable for a member of the intelligentsia of England to maintain that the Earth was created on October the 5th, 4006 BC at 10 a.m. That was a respectable opinion in the middle class Episcopal gentry of Victorian England. So what is happening is that things are getting weirder fast. 1923 was an enormous watershed when the ever stodgy edifice of physics, which had been rocked to its foundations by Einsteinian relativity, encountered the notion of the quanta, the uncertainty principle, the role of the observer in the production of measurement at the heart of nature. This is what I call discovering that the bedrock is a funhouse basement. And as we have prosecuted the frontiers of knowledge over the past 50 years, it's only our incredible lack of historical perspective that keeps us, I think, resistant to the idea that we are in the gravitational tug of an enormous attractor that must lie ahead of us in time, not very far. How far can it be? To my mind, people who talk about how things are going to be in 500 years or 1,000 years have atrophy of the frontal cortex. I mean, what Mark said either this morning or last night about the difference between 1990 and 1998 in terms of the internet, 1998 lies farther from 1990 by a great distance than 1990 lies from 1900. The acceleration has become overwhelming. Now, we have built-in defenses against this, which is, it's almost like the expanding universe theory, except it's apply it to the intellectual universe. The intellectual universe is expanding at such an enormous rate that most people embedded in a professional field cannot see beyond the boundaries of their own technical concern. So the people in nanotechnology have no idea what's going on in, let's say, information compression or environmental restoration or something else. Every science is reaching, every field of technology is reaching towards some kind of holy grail of its own special set of concerns. But there's no information being communicated along the face of the wave. And into this intellectual chasm of understanding that the rapid acceleration of historical processes created pours the energy of cult. We have become a people ruled by rumors of the improbable. We're told that, you know, human fetal tissue is being traded for fiber optic technology by back channel sections of our own government. We're told that extraterrestrials of dozens of shapes and sizes are running around in the trailer courts of America. We're told that the Antarctic ice cap is about to melt, that planetesimal objects are headed toward Earth, that Christ and Elvis were seen arm in arm down at the mall, on and on. Well, people say it's the millennium or it's the breakdown of consensus reality. It is all of that, but I think it's embedded deeper. I think it's embedded almost in the physics or dynamics of planetary complexity in this on the surface of this planet. In answer to your question, will it ever break through? Will there ever be an aha moment? I think there will. I think it will come sometime after the millennium, some, like 2006, something like that. Because first of all, the echoes and resonances of the millennium must die away. And we must understand that it wasn't simply the year 2000 or Y2K or the Christer expectation of millenarian dispensation. That nothing can turn off these processes that have been operating for such very long spans of time. And it is absolutely unreasonable at this point to suppose that any force could intervene to stop what is happening. Well, then people say, well, then are we just to disappear up our own virtual wazoo? Or what? How are we to picture this? Well, I think that's like asking us to see around several corners at once. The things which will happen between here and 2012 will rewrite the disk of reality several times. If 1994 and 1998 can be separated by centuries of technological progress, then what is it going to be like in 2002 when the T1 connection becomes the standard connection for most people on the internet, when virtual reality is completely trivial, when everyone moves much of the time through virtual code-created spaces? Well, probably it will appear very humdrum because we will have gotten used to it by then. But what we will be asked to get used to at that point is the perfection of quantum teleportation, the possibility of essentially turning the entire physical universe into the equivalent of an electromagnetic medium of some sort. And I think that the breakdown of consensus reality, the breakdown of physics, the breakdown of models about what is happening will eventually lead to a complete overheating of the official engines of explanation. This is what lies behind the belief that the government is about to come clean about flying saucers, or it's about to come clean about the ruins on Mars. These are in fact chimeras in the popular mind, but they indicate the realization that reality is slipping out of anybody's control. The thing that amuses me about conspiracy theory is that it propounds the obvious preposterous notion that the system can be guided and controlled. You want to go beyond the hair-raising terror of conspiracy theory, then lock in on the concept that no one is in charge. Not the Jews, not the Vatican, not the German government, not the World Bank, not the Catholic Church. Nobody. The whole thing is under the aegis of dynamics that are out of the reach of human institutions and human intentionality at the institutional and individual level. Well, so then people call that chaos, and they say, well, it's just flinging itself apart, it's melting down. No, it's not. As it exceeds our ability to control its direction, it actually reveals its real ontos. You know, that we are not cattle for Christ. We are not socialist automatons. We are not bearers of the genes of the master race. We are none of these squirrely ideas. We are something else, which is in the process of unfolding. And I think eventually, to answer your question, this will become the central product of the human race. Instead of discussing the eschaton on at the edges. And I've watched it move from the real edges. I mean, I was into this in 1973 when it made no sense to anybody, including me. I just said it because I was hopelessly insane and had no choice. And I've watched it move in and in. And, you know, now you can go on the internet. There are these people called singularists. These are guys with pen protectors, for sure. And yet they believe that by calculating rates of data compression, density of computer architecture, human population, energy release, velocities attained, so forth and so on, you draw all these curves out, and lo and behold, somewhere between 2010 and 2025, we possess all information, move at infinite speeds, release infinite amounts of energy, live forever, and so forth and so on. People say, well, what does this mean? Can these curves possibly hold these vectors? I think the answer is yes. But the fulfillment of these things will occur in dimensions very difficult for us to grok or imagine. What I love about what I do is that I get to read all the hot new stuff, and I think about it, and I think about it, and every once in a while a piece of information comes floating down the pike that lifts an edge right. of the veil, and I see 3 months further into the future or 6 months further into the future. For instance, in the last 6 months, I have understood that processor speed